On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Most people start in broadcast, and then when they're really successful, they say, I don't have to do this grind anymore.
Right.
I'm going to cable, where I can do good work, and I don't have to do 22 episodes. I went backwards.
Writer and producer Eileen Chaiken created the Showtime drama The L Word, but her time at a cable network didn't prepare her for the roller coaster of running the Fox hit Empire, which is still roaring in the ratings in its second season. And New Yorker contributor Robert Draper recently profiled Mexican actress Kate Del Castillo. He talks about the superstar who set up that infamous meeting between Sean Penn and the drug lord El Chapo. But first on the News Banter, super agents Ari Emanuel and Patrick Weitzel say they're going to drink CAA's milkshake. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hello there.
So you had a cover story in The Hollywood Reporter this past week. The first interview given by Ari Emanuel and Patrick Weitzel, the co-heads of William Morris Endeavor, IMG, which is the biggest agency in the business right now. Ari Emanuel, of course, famously the model for Ari Gold in Entourage. Patrick Weitzel, a very capable agent who came of age representing Ben Affleck and Matt Damon from the very beginning of their careers until now. Just going back historically, Ari Emanuel started Endeavor, which Patrick Weitzel joined from rival CAA. They then took over William Morris and just swallowed it up. This little guppy swallowed this whale. And then they acquired IMG, which is the most recent and by far the riskiest of their moves. They took on a lot of debt. And as I'm sure you're going to explain right now, IMG is a very diverse entity with a lot of interests.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the Hollywood equivalent for sports and fashion. It represents athletes. It represents college sports programs. It has a licensing division, a media division. They create content for European soccer leagues and golf and Wimbledon. So merging that company with the traditional Hollywood talent agency of WME has not been an easy task. And what Ari and Patrick explain in this interview is that they've basically gone in there and made changes where they needed to. When they took over Fashion Week's, three sponsors immediately bailed. So they bring in new sponsors. They moved it out of Lincoln Center. They've done a lot of things to build up that IMG business, and they've used a lot of the money that they had and they raised from the private equity group that they're partnered with to go out and buy things. They've bought the Professional Bull Riding Association. They bought the Miss Universe pageant from Donald Trump, who's a former client of theirs. They bought a hairstyling agency. They've bought all these different aspects of entertainment that are non-traditional Hollywood agency businesses. And what they're trying to do is create a mega agency, mega conglomerate that will not only outstripe CAA, but could eventually go public someday.
Well, and CAA is also backed by private equity. And the truth about private equity is they always invest in a company and then try to take it public or sell it and make money. It's been a lot of question, like, does that work with an agency where the assets famously go home at night? You know, an agency is a collection of people. CAA has tried to diversify as well, but nowhere near on the scale of WME IMG. And then another rival, like United Talent Agency, makes a big point of, you know, we're not doing that. We're focusing on our clients, the talent, the actors. And if you want, you know, real attention, you'll come to us. So, of course, they're still constantly slinging off on each other. Ari Emanuel, you know, is sort of infamously aggressive and cannot resist, even now that he's presiding over this gigantic entity, making comments, as he did in your interview, about CAA.
Oh, yeah. He says they're freaking out. He cites the poor television business that their clients, Will Smith and Brad Pitt, have had. I mean, he does poke some fingers in their eye. But the overall issue here is WME believes they are building a platform. They are building a giant international media conglomerate that, in their view, will raise all boats. It will help their celebrity clients who want to get into fashion, who want to be a spokesperson for a golf league or a tennis league. And they also believe that having the celebrity angle will help athletes. And, you know, they're saying they can get their athletes into TV deals. They can get their models on into movies. And that by creating this diversified company, it will ultimately help everyone. That's the big, you know, $2.4 billion question, which is how much it costs to buy IMG. Is it going to help everyone, or are they just going to be saddled with this debt and with, you know, servicing this debt to the point where ultimately it's not going to be a feasible business?
And of course, spread too thin is what their competitors hope. So the time will tell. I'm going to turn now to Cannes, which is coming up in May. Cannes is going to be opened this year by a Woody Allen film, which in and of itself is not like shocking news. It's called Café Society. It stars Steve Carell, Jesse Eisenberg, Blake Lively, and Kristen Stewart. What's interesting about it is that this is a film that Amazon paid a very hefty, and this is, again, in the world of Woody Allen, hefty, $15 million for. So Amazon Studios is going to have the opening movie at Cannes.
Yeah, that's something that I think even 5 years ago, people would have said, what? The place I buy my socks is going to premiere a movie at Cannes? But, you know, they are stepping up. Amazon and Netflix are the two most aggressive buyers of independent film right now. And that's the fact. I mean, you look at what Amazon did at Sundance. They paid $10 million for a Kenneth Lonergan movie. They outbid, you know, almost any other movie there except for the one that went to Fox Searchlight for $17.5. So the fact that they're premiering at Cannes, I think, is a big opportunity to showcase what they're doing. And they believe that this Woody Allen movie, unlike some of his past ones, is a more commercial and popular outing. It's more in the vein of Midnight in Paris, which was the period travelogue movie that did very well for Sony Pictures Classics about 5 years ago. They believe that this movie is like that and that it justified the expense. But Woody Allen movies are famously hit and miss. And, you know, the audience sometimes shows up, the audience sometimes doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, this takes Woody Allen away from Sony Pictures Classics, which has been the home of the last 8 Woody Allen movies. And, you know, they outbid Sony Pictures Classics, which has got to be an uncomfortable thing, you know, especially Sony Pictures Classics in the independent world notoriously doesn't like to cough up a ton of money for anything. And guess what? Amazon and Netflix do right now because that's their
right.
their way in.
And that is essentially the push-pull in the independent film business right now, is that these companies like Sony Pictures Classics and Fox Searchlight, they exist because they pay a price for films. They don't break the bank. They pay a small price for films, and they release very strategically. When you have an open checkbook company like Amazon or like Netflix that comes into these film festivals willing to just spend what they need to spend, it really upends the business, and it causes a place like Sony Pictures Classic to have to forego a relationship with a filmmaker like Woody Allen that they've had for a long time.
The other thing is that Amazon, unlike Netflix, is willing to leave a theatrical window, and that means they're going to be more appealing, I think, to some filmmakers because Netflix has had a real problem, even with all the bag of money, getting, you know, people want their movies in theaters, not streaming day and date as they open in a movie theater so that people can watch them at home.
Yeah, that's exactly the difference that Amazon is offering. They are agreeing to partner with a traditional theatrical distributor to give these movies a theatrical release and to hold from Amazon Prime the movie for about, you know, 90 days, 60 days. So there is that theatrical window. And going back to Patrick Whitesell at WME, I spoke with him about this issue because he represents Kenny Lonergan, the director of the movie Manchester by the Sea that sold to Amazon at Sundance. And he said point blank, he's like, we're looking to see how they do with this. They paid a big price, but what's the theatrical campaign going to look like? If it's Oscar worthy, what's that campaign look like? Filmmakers still want to see their movies in theaters, and they want to know that it's going to get an Oscar push if it's that kind of movie. And I think these agents are really looking to see what Amazon and Netflix are going to do with these films.
And of course, in terms of Oscars, that is someplace where Sony Pictures Classics has delivered, and they know what they're doing. So as you say, we'll wait and see how the streaming services do. And it seems to me on this department, for at least, Amazon is pulling a little bit ahead of Netflix, unless Netflix breaks down and respects the theatrical window. Meanwhile, let me just turn quickly to a topic. We're going to have the showrunner of Empire on the show today. Empire, we just had a story about how, despite the fact that it came back with a huge bang this past week when it returned from a hiatus, big ratings numbers, it is not doing well overseas. And that is unfortunate because it shows that there still seems to be a race barrier where foreign audiences are concerned.
Yeah, I mean, we at Hollywood Reporter, we talked to a number of these foreign television executives, and they say that Empire hasn't really worked, and a lot of these shows with diverse casts that have worked in the U.S., and obviously that's been a big push in the U.S. over the past few years, they're not performing as well overseas, and the audience there is less enthusiastically accepting of these shows. So it gets to that chicken and egg question. If this is what's happening in the U.S. television business, but the foreign market is so important and the sales figures overseas are so important, is the lack of an audience overseas going to start to impact the willingness of U.S. studios to make these kind of shows?
Well, I hope optimistically that it will be the other way around and the overseas audiences will become more open to diverse casting. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. Earlier this year, actor Sean Penn became mired in controversy when Rolling Stone published his secret interview with then-fugitive Joaquin Guzman Loera, the Mexican drug lord known as El Chapo. The two men were brought together by an unlikely liaison, Mexican actress Kate Del Castillo. Though Del Castillo has yet to break through in English-language television, she is widely adored for her defining role in the Telemundo telenovela La Reina del Sur. 4 years ago, Del Castillo sent out a long, freeform tweet in which she spoke favorably of the notoriously murderous El Chapo, saying she trusted him more than the Mexican government. Then she got a phone call from El Chapo's lawyers, as she later told ABC News.
I was in shock. I was in shock. And they say, well, Señor Guzman wants you to do a movie about him. He wants to give you the rights of his life. And I was, why me? And they say, well, because he is a fan of yours. He loved your character in La Reina del Sur. And you tell the truth. You're brave.
Del Castillo recruited two Argentine producers who in turn connected her with Sean Penn. According to Del Castillo's account, she expected Penn to help her figure out how to bring an El Chapo film to the big screen. Penn has said his only intention was to write an article based on an interview with the drug lord. Journalist Robert Draper recently profiled Del Castillo in The New Yorker. He spoke to KCRW's Madeline Brand about the many apparent misunderstandings between the actress and Sean Penn.
Well, it seems inconceivable that they wouldn't have had a frank conversation about what each person wanted before they boarded that charter plane and headed out to meet El Chapo. And she says that the first time that she had an inkling that he wanted to do an article on El Chapo was when she was translating right there on the spot between Penn and El Chapo.
That's right. And there are different memories or different assertions as to whether or not she knew from the very beginning. Sean Penn claims that she did when they first met on September the 22nd at a hotel in Santa Monica. He says that he told her from the outset he was doing a magazine story. So obviously it depends on who you believe. The two producers who are close to Penn say that, yeah, the subject had come up. I suppose you could imagine that the two producers didn't want to look like they were being deceitful by pulling the wool over the eyes of their colleague in this movie project. But rather than me make a judgment on exactly who's telling the truth in this, I just simply sort of put all those versions out there to let the reader decide for him or herself.
Right. So she had the rights to his life story before she stepped foot on that charter airplane. What did she think Sean Penn was going to bring to this whole project?
Credibility and a big name. Even when El Chapo became famous in America as a result of his jailbreak in July of last year, it was not a fait accompli that some major motion picture could come out of that in Hollywood. It takes big names to be involved to get money in. And so the belief shared by Del Castillo and the two producers was that Sean Penn would be an asset in that regard. Whether he would ultimately direct it, whether he would be a producer, it was their view, admittedly vague, so they say at the time, that he would just in some way or other give his imprimatur, be involved in it, and that would assist them when they needed to build financing down the road.
But this was never discussed?
No, apparently not. And I think that, you know, the view was, let's let his interest play out in this. Let's see if he really develops an interest in it before we try to become heavy-handed. So goes their version of events. Again, Sean Penn's version of events is that no movie project was ever discussed, and had it been, he would have shut it down immediately because he had one interest and one interest only, and that was to meet El Chapo in the furtherance of this story he was doing for Rolling Stone.
So it's safe to say that for all the major parties involved in this drama, none of their aspirations were realized.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, for Sean Penn, it depends on what, I mean, he says now that his aspiration was to start a conversation on the war on drugs, but that's not entirely the case because his aspiration was in the immediate to meet El Chapo, to satisfy his intellectual curiosity and to indulge in what he himself terms experiential journalism. In that sense, mission accomplished. It failed to start a conversation on the war on drugs, but then again, a story that's 10,000 words in length, about 7,500 words being devoted to his experience, his adventure, it's not terribly surprising. As for Kate Del Castillo, it's landed her in legal difficulty that the experience of going to see El Chapo and being surveilled, essentially. But it remains to be seen whether this means no movie for Kate Del Castillo and El Chapo. She still owns the rights, and El Chapo, through an attorney of his, told the Associated Press just recently that, in his view, she not only owns the rights, but that the movie is more important to put out than ever. So it could, for her at least, have a happy ending.
But, and he doesn't blame her for his rearrest?
No, he does not. Really, the fault, if it resides anywhere, resides with Guzman, with El Chapo himself. After all, he, with no one putting a gun to his head, initiated contact with her, a rather dangerous thing to be doing, and a surprisingly dangerous thing for a guy who is a wily fugitive, and gave the okay for her and Sean Penn to come visit him at a time when he was a fugitive. Now, I should point out, though, Madeline, that the Mexican government claimed at the time of El Chapo's arrest that one of the reasons that they were able to arrest him was that they had been surveilling Sean Penn and Kate Del Castillo. However, that meeting, which took place on October the 2nd, was months before they actually caught the guy, and in a totally different location. So it's a little bit of a stretch from an evidentiary standpoint to suggest that the one led to the other.
Hmm. So she's here in Los Angeles, not returning to Mexico because she's afraid she's going to be arrested?
Yeah, there is a provision in Mexican federal statutes that allows the Mexican government to put her under house arrest for a period of 80 days while they're investigating her without bringing any formal charges against her. And so her attorneys in Mexico have advised her that it's better for her to stay in the U.S. She lives in Los Angeles anyway, but this is a problem for her. She not only because she has friends and family in Mexico, but because she was supposed to be shooting a Netflix movie at about this time in Mexico. They've put that on hold. They're going to wait until this situation is cleared up. And the means by which it presumably will clear up will be as a result of an investigation of her that's taking place here in the U.S. by the U.S. Department of Justice on money laundering charges. Kate Del Castillo and her attorneys are hoping that the Department of Justice here will audit her tequila business, which, so goes the belief of the Mexican government or the apparent belief that El Chapo may have been mingling money with, that an audit of that business, an audit for that matter of all of her bank accounts, I think she only has two of them, will yield the conclusion that there's no money laundering taking place. If that happens and the U.S. Department of Justice comes to that conclusion, then the burden essentially will fall on the Mexican government to prove, and presumably prove pretty soon, that she's committed some kind of financial malfeasance in concert with El Chapo. And if she doesn't do that, then they will have to close the investigation and she'll be able to go about her business in Mexico.
Robert Draper is an author and New Yorker contributor whose profile of Kate Del Castillo is called The Go-Between, the Mexican actress who dazzled El Chapo. Robert, thank you.
My pleasure, Madeline.
Coming up after a short break, two writer-producers, Eileen Chaikin and Michelle Ashford, tell us how they crashed and burned, that's their words, in their careers before finding success with their own shows. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters.
I'm going to take Camilla out from the inside. I just got to get back in Empire.
How you going to get back in?
You just let Cookie handle that.
Fox's hit series Empire has just resumed its second season with a ratings bang. That means Taraji P. Henson and Terrence Howard are back as Cookie and Lucius Lyon, now trying to regain control of their record label. Today we're talking with two showrunners, Eileen Chaykin of Empire and Michelle Ashford, creator of Showtime's Masters of Sex. The two sat down to talk about their very different paths to success with my sometime banter partner, Michael Schneider, at this year's meeting of the National Association of Television Program Executives. Chaykin told Mike that years ago, she could not have imagined she'd be overseeing one of broadcast's sudsiest soap operas.
I started as a television executive and worked for probably 10 years developing and putting together shows and movies. And then crashed and burned as an executive and locked myself in a room and wrote a script and said, I'm a writer now.
Yeah.
And then for the next 10 years wrote movies and then just stumbled into writing television because I had an idea, which turned out to be the show called The L Word, which is a show I did for Showtime. And in the course of that, became a television writer.
How does one crash and burn as an executive, though? Is it something that just wasn't your thing?
It's so easy. You don't have to try too hard.
Yeah.
It was in part that I always wanted to be a writer and a filmmaker and finally just got tired of not doing what I came to Hollywood to do.
Yeah.
But it was also, you know, there's that little backstabbing thing that goes on when you're an executive.
Yeah. Oh, the politics.
The politics, yeah.
And Michelle, how about you? What's your origin story?
I also crashed and burned, but not in a glamorous way like Eileen. I started doing all the small, hard jobs of being an assistant and a receptionist. I did that for a while. And then I found myself in the world of television doing that work. And as I looked around, I realized it was the writers who seemed to be doing all the interesting work. So I, too, quit and spent a year trying to write scripts and figure it out. And it just happened to work out, luckily, and have been doing it ever since.
I feel like you guys may have missed, like, left out a little portion, though. I mean, it's not that easy. It's not that easy to break in, and you guys both managed to sort of created these really successful careers. I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who wonder, is it the classic, it's who you know? Is it just right time, right place? Is it just, write a killer spec? What was sort of the process in really kind of hunkering down and getting those scripts going?
I think it's different for everyone. I think that if being a writer, a showrunner, a show creator is your goal, then it's all about writing and never stopping and writing more and writing wherever and however you can. And whether you're writing on other people's shows and learning your craft in that way or just studying and observing and writing, that's what it's about.
Well, I think it is a real process, and I did start off writing on other people's shows, and so I think then I was just hopeful that I could be a good mimic, that I would learn someone else's voice and could replicate it. Mm-hmm. But Eileen and I were just talking about how working on a TV show is really laborious, hard work, and so after doing that on other people's shows for not very long, I think 3 years, I thought, well, if I'm going to work this hard, I really want it to be on my own show.
Yeah.
And as a result, I just wrote pilots for many, many years. And occasionally one would get on, but then the first thing that I got on was against Seinfeld, and we just got killed. So that didn't last very long.
Yeah.
But in the process of writing pilots, which is very similar to writing screenplays, because you have to create a whole world from scratch, you start to understand where your voice is. But then I got actually very frustrated with network television at one point, and that was right around when The Sopranos was coming out, and I thought, oh, well, that's what you can do.
Right.
And so I sort of reinvented my career at that point, and I did it by writing a script for HBO, in fact, a pilot, that was such a different sample of writing than the writing I had been doing, that all of a sudden it sort of put me in a different area, and it was the area I just felt much more comfortable in.
What's interesting is, you know, in this age of all these shows, especially premium cable and now streaming, we've gone to a different model where so many shows now are 10 episodes, 12 episodes at most. You guys did, what, 12 last year?
We did.
Yeah. You're still doing 24?
Well, no. We are doing 18
this year. Yeah.
But last year, you know, Empire came on at mid-season, and we did 12 episodes. And I had this kind of backwards career trajectory, which is that I started in cable and then went to broadcast. Most people start in broadcast, and then when they're really successful, they say, I don't have to do this grind anymore.
Right.
I'm going to cable where I can do good work and I don't have to do 22 episodes. I went backwards.
Yeah.
But this is the first time in my life that I've ever done more than 13 episodes of a season.
How's that going?
I'm not done yet, and look at me. I'm a shell of my former self.
Oh, no. It's a little easier that it is one of the hottest shows on television. That's got to motivate you.
It's motivating, not necessarily easier in terms of the amount of work, but certainly motivating.
Yeah. Talk about this last year. I mean, that must have been a ride. Week after week, the Nielsens were up, and you must have been, is this ever going to stop?
That was horrifying, you know, because it was inevitably going to stop at some point, and really all you can anticipate, and we don't do it for the numbers, and we don't focus on the numbers, but of course you can't miss that when it's happening. I mean, it gets talked about a lot, and from the moment it started, all I could think about was, this is going to stop at some point, and that's going to suck.
Was there a moment where you realized, you know, because obviously the networks launch a lot of shows, that as this thing became big, oh, this is going to be Fox's priority. Like, they're going to pay attention to us.
To Fox's credit, before the show even debuted, they knew they had something special. I don't think anybody knew that it was going to be a hit in the way that it was, but they put incredible resources behind launching the show. They knew that there was something there, and it was worth investing in and worth promoting. And the fact that the show debuted as big as it did is in large part due to their incredible marketing campaign, because nobody knew what Empire was. And yes, Terrence Howard was a star, and Taraji Henson was known to people, but there was no reason why it should debut so big and keep getting bigger. They launched it brilliantly.
One of the things that's kind of interesting at the moment, we see what's going on the film side, the controversy over the Oscar nominees, the lack of diversity, and what's kind of interesting is TV is so far ahead right now of the film world in that aspect as well, in terms of diversity opportunities for people of color, but also women. It does seem like things have advanced. Do you guys agree? Do you think we're getting there, or do you think TV still also has a long way to go?
Both. We clearly are ahead of the movie side of the business, and there have been great evolutionary changes in the last couple of years, but the numbers tell the story that we really still have a long way to go in television too.
I mean, I've never really approached it from that point of view, although when our show went on, my producing partner Sarah Timmerman obviously is a woman, and people said, oh, this is a show run by women. We thought, okay. I mean, we kind of didn't identify it like that. We're just like, well, let's just get our show on the air.
And,
but it was noticed. And we hired, our first year, we had 3 episodes directed by women. And we certainly have a staff that's filled with women. But, you know, for example, we got dinged for not having any women directors last year. And the truth was, is we tried to. And we actually had people that fell out, women that fell out as directors. And so you're aware of this, that you want to improve these numbers as much as you can. You're also just trying to get your job done. And I think it's in process. But TV's has made great strides.
You can hear more of Michael Schneider's conversation with Eileen Chaiken and Michelle Ashford on KCRW's podcast, The Spinoff. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business. From the bottom, I got up to the top of the pros, from the gutter to the shutter trimmed out.